if John were to say, look, I know stuff because I was the CIA director and I saw some stuff that you guys haven't seen yet, you people out in the public, I do think that is across the prudential limit. So Jack and I think are in agreement probably in the concept and maybe differ in the application.
Yeah, I actually think that the line is a little different than that. I think, obviously, Brennan has not said anything that extreme. The problem is that in his tweets and in some of his writings and some of his television appearances, he just hasn't made it clear, you know, whether he's relying on information that he had inside the government. And sometimes, in my judgment, he implies that some of his judgments are based on what he saw that have been confirmed by what's on the outside. So I think that prudence commands much more caution.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 28th, 2018. This is a peculiar edition of the Lawfare Podcast. It grows out of an exchange on email between David Criss and Jack Goldsmith over a draft article Jack had written about John Brennan and other intelligence community former leaders who were criticizing the president in public and whom the president was threatening to pull their security clearances in response. David Criss sent comments. Jack assimilated those comments, and a remarkable exchange occurred in the process by email. I responded by inviting both to have this discussion on the Lawfare Podcast, and that is this week's episode. It's a bit freeform, it's a bit freewheeling, but it's a discussion of what is it appropriate for intelligence community leaders to say about the president? What is going too far? What is outside their lane? And what is required by the current moment when intelligence community leaders face a rogue elephant of a president who is violating every norm we know? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 342, What is Too Far When Former IC Leadership Criticizes the President? So, Jack, get us started. You know, lay out the argument that you made in your piece, and specifically the critique of Brennan and others who have taken, other former public officials who have taken a very critical and overtly critical line toward the president.
Yes, thank you, Ben. My piece was motivated by the dispute between President Trump and former CIA Director Brennan. And as I said in the piece, I thought that that dispute implicated two unfortunate trends that had come to pass during the Trump administration. The first was the deeply unfortunate politicization of intelligence. Ben and I have written about this. We've all written about this, actually. Politicization that is the bane of the intelligence community because they depend on public trust and public credibility to be able to perform their secret missions to keep us safe. And as Ben and I started writing a couple of years ago, I mean, this is one of the great dangers of Trump's really outrageous attacks and public disbelief in the intelligence community is that he seems to be trying to, and has since the beginning of his administration, tried to call into question the validity and credibility of the intelligence community, their competence, whether they have conflicts of interest, whether they're serving their own interests and not the country's and the like. And that's really in itself, I think, unprecedented to have a president attack the intelligence community in that way. And it's deeply damaging all by itself. I think the problem was exacerbated in some of the steps that we don't know who took these steps, but as with other institutions, I think some of the reactions to President Trump have hurt the institutions as well in violating their own norms. And I have mainly in mind here those early and really quite extraordinary and multiple FISA intelligence, FISA leaks that contained U.S. person information, the ones concerning the president's son-in-law and the president's national security advisor. They breached norms even, as I once put it, in the Wild West of classified leaks. Those intelligence leaks breached extraordinary norms in releasing U.S. person information, and seemingly to do so to decapitate elements high up in the presidency in ways that were not unprecedented, of course, but that recalled Hoover's time, J. Edgar Hoover's time in the FBI. So that's the background in which I sought to criticize. And really, in the end, in that piece, I didn't criticize the members of the intelligence community who've chosen to spoke out. As I said, it's a contextual and personal decision. There are two questions: whether to defend the intelligence community, as no one in the government is defending the intelligence community from the president's attacks, and so just like I felt, and just like we've felt, a need to defend and explain, some of the people who worked in the administrations, in the presidential administration more recently, have felt compelled to defend them. My view ultimately in that piece is that that's a personal call, and that there are costs and benefits from doing so, and that the president may win either way, because if they remain silent, there's no one defending them. But if they engage in standing up to the president, at least in certain ways, it may confirm his charge that they are in fact politicized, that they have an agenda contrary to the elected presidents and the like. And that finally brings me to Mr. Brennan, who I said, I know John Brennan a bit. I worked with him. I like him a lot. I think he was a great CIA director. But I do think he's crossed lines, and he's admitted that to some degree. And Jim Clapper basically said something similar. I think he's crossed a lot of lines. I think he's an example of someone who's gone too far. And he's, I think that's why the president chose him, frankly, in pulling his security clearance, because of the reaction he thought he would spark.
David, what part of that do you agree with, and what part of it do you disagree with?
Well, at the outset, of course, there's vast areas of violent agreement between Jack and myself on this, as to, you know, Mr. Trump's behavior and the extent to which it violates all kinds of really important norms that are central to our democracy and the whole idea of a rule of law system. I also certainly agree that leaking classified information, including FISA information, is a bad thing, very bad, violates norms. And I share Jack's concerns about what I'll call sort of the tactical or empirical outcomes that may follow here. That is, Trump is very good at political maneuvering, and I am concerned that, you know, he may ultimately profit. I think we may have a couple of differences, or it may be that I'm not quite understanding Jack's points with the requisite precision or subtlety, but even if that's the case, it's still probably worth having the conversation, as I may not be alone. I think there's a narrow, potentially narrow disagreement about a specific norm and how it applies here. And then I also have a broader potential disagreement with Jack, sort of more focused on the way he frames the issues. So let me just say a word about each of those, and then we can see whether any of them are worth unpacking further. On the narrow front, Jack, I think, rightly identifies that there is a norm against criticizing the president that applies even to former senior officials of the intelligence community, which is premised and founded on the idea that we want to have apolitical intelligence. And the same applies to the U.S. military, where similar kinds of doctrines or norms of restraint typically apply. And so Jack is asking the question, is more restraint or silence from these former officials required in light of these important principles of apolitical intelligence and military conduct? And from my point of view, although I think that apolitical intelligence and military is vitally important and a critical foundational principle of our democracy because they have so much power, I think in the current circumstances, given the way that the president is behaving, the sort of the relevant question here is not so much whether there's a norm that demands restraint, but rather whether the norm compels or merely permits the sharp criticism of the president. So for me, although we, I think, agree that there's a norm emerging from this foundational principle of apolitical intelligence, I think we may disagree in the direction from which the relevant application of that norm emerges. So to me, the question is there in fact an obligation in these people, not just a permission, to speak out sharply against the president, whereas I see Jack coming at it from the other direction. And you know, fundamentally, my reasoning, and it's based on my own experience in which I have felt compelled to speak out in ways that I would not have is because the president is so far out of bounds. He is so many standard deviations out from the mean. This is not just a partisan political debate between, you know, George W. Bush and Barack Obama or Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. This is way, way out there attacking foundational elements of our democracy. And I think it is more apolitical to criticize those extreme deviations than it is to allow them to pass in silence. And as I say, I myself have really felt the compulsion to speak out in ways which I never would have liked doing. My preferred mode of communicating with other people is with a 100-page paper with 200 footnotes that nobody reads.
Yeah, we got to talk about that, David.
Yes. Well, it has now, I find myself, though, you know, on the television and in the radio and on the Twitter. And it's not a comfortable medium for me, but I do feel it's one that I have had to use because I feel an obligation. So anyway, that's the sort of narrow norm differentiation that I would draw between myself and Jack, potentially, or again, it may be a misunderstanding.
So I don't think I disagree with anything you said, David. I think there,
damn, I think it's going to be a boring podcast.
No, we'll find something to disagree about. There are three questions, I think, three relevant questions here. Well, before we even get to the relevant questions, there's a question of what is the norm of former officials being very cautious about speaking out and disagreeing and attacking the president. And there's a delicate question about whether there's a norm violation here or whether the norm doesn't apply because the preconditions for the norm, which is the president acting in good faith, have been lifted. Maybe so. So I think there are three relevant questions. One, is it okay, is it acceptable in this context for these officials to speak out? I think the answer to that is yes. And as I said in the piece, ultimately, and you helped me to see this, David, in some earlier discussions, I think that's a personal decision. I don't think that there's an obligation to speak out, but I think that especially when no one else is defending the intelligence agencies, that it's in this context appropriate to speak up and call the president out on his lies and his misleading statements and his attacks on people's integrity and the like. Second question is it effective? What goal is it being served? Is it bringing more benefits than costs? That's where in the piece several times and still today, I just don't know. I think it serves many benefits. I mean, it stands up to the president. It provides a counterpoint to him. And for certain audiences, it's helpful in clarifying what the president is up to. I think before other audiences, it confirms a lot of the president's critiques. And I frankly just don't know how that cost-benefit calculus cuts. I think it probably depends on the issue, and if it depends on the official, and depends on how that official speaks out. The third question, though, is if it's okay, and there's a question whether it's effective, is what are the proper limits? And I'll call them prudential limits, because I would never say that any of these officials would never say, other than not disclosing classified information, that there's something they don't have a right to say. And there, I do think there are some limits that the officials should watch. And the one that I pointed out in the piece is, I think they should be very careful about talking about and making claims about the Russia investigation and accusing the president of things for which he's under investigation when they worked on those issues and had access to classified information in the government. It's a very blurry line. And even if they take steps to clarify that the information that they're criticizing the president, not based on information they saw, but on some other basis, I think that's a very dodgy area to be engaging with the president, given that he's under investigation. So there's more to say, but those are the three questions. And I think we agree on the first two, and I'm not sure about the third. Maybe not the second either.
Yeah. So, David, what do you think the prudential limits are? Is there anything that Brennan did that with which you're uncomfortable, or is your attitude that, you know, there may have been a little bit of rhetorical excess in some of the comments, but basically that he didn't cross any lines, you know, prudential, let alone others.
I do share Jack's concern about the effectiveness potentially here. I'll have something more to say about that when we get to the broader point, because I think I come at it from a slightly different perspective, leading to sort of a slightly different emphasis in the way I tee up the issue. But I acknowledge that there is a risk of collateral damage here that's unintended, although in for me at least, you know, it doesn't counsel overly restrained behavior for fear of that. And I also agree that there are some prudential limits short of the outright disclosure of classified. I think it is not ideal for a government, a former government official with access to classified or other non-public information from his or her government experience to be affirmatively suggesting or trying to leave the impression that they can reach a conclusion based on the secret information that others don't have access to, and that you should just sort of trust them because they've seen the really juicy stuff. I don't think that that is wise or a good idea. I am not at all sure that Brennan is doing that. I have to say, before I say anything specific about John, you know, more than Jack has said, I consider myself a friend of Brennan. We served together for a number of years in very, you know, challenging circumstances under intense pressure, and we've become and maintained our friendship across all, you know, the years since 2009. So whatever I say probably needs to be taken with a grain of salt. Also, I have not attempted systematically to review John's statements, including any disclaimers he may have made. But my sense is that his point is actually fundamentally that all of this is happening right in front of us, in plain sight, on the stage in Helsinki, and in the president's quite, you know, extreme tweets, and in his statements, you know, asking the Russians to hack Hillary's emails and so forth and so on. And there's certainly ample room there for extreme criticism. But if John were to say, look, I know stuff because I was the CIA director and I saw some stuff that you guys haven't seen yet, you people out in the public, I do think that is across the prudential limit. So Jack and I think are in agreement probably in the concept and maybe differ in the application.
Yeah, I actually think that the line's a little different than that. I think, and obviously Brennan has not said anything that extreme. The problem is, and I can go through the statements if you want, but I don't think it's necessary. The problem is that in his tweets and in some of his writings and some of his television appearances, he just hasn't made it clear. I mean, he's whether he's relying on information that he had inside the government, and sometimes in my judgment, he implies that some of his judgments are based on what he saw that have been confirmed by what's on the outside. So I think that prudence commands much more caution. And I haven't seen, and I haven't studied this carefully, I haven't studied it comprehensively, but I haven't seen the other officials be quite as undisciplined as he is in charging ahead and accusing the president of things and not making clear or being ambiguous about or leaving uncertain whether he's basing that on things he knows about or whether it's based, and sometimes he talks about things that have happened after he left government. So I would say that there's a greater demand for serious caution there.
So what about a different category of statement, which is ones that are highly, highly political, but nowhere near lines of classified information? So for example, you know, Brennan has made a number of tweets that are just characterizations of the president, generally written in the second person. You are this, that, and the other. The people will, you know, eventually leave you in the dustbin of history, right? And Jim Comey has made similar, I mean, they have a different edge to them, more sort of the personality of Jim Comey than the personality of John Brennan. But they're both, there's no remote question that they don't implicate their prior responsibilities. On the other hand, it just isn't the way former senior intelligence and law enforcement people typically talk. Is that within the area of your concern, Jack, or outside it? And David, how do you feel about it?
It's within my area of concern. I don't think they're prohibited from doing so. I think it's imprudent because it makes them seem more political than they are and therefore undermines or potentially undermines the message of protecting apolitical intelligence that they're trying to protect. And I'll just add another category, and Brennan is the only one I've seen do this, and I don't mean to be beating up on him, but he's the one that I've noticed this most with. He's also he's also been attacking the president in pretty extreme terms on for policies that the president's following that he was elected on his trade policy. I had three tweets really attacking his trade policy, tracking his immigration policy, attacking his Middle East policy, his Jerusalem embassy policy, all things worthy of debate and disagreement. But query whether that also is prudent or whether that makes him seem like he's a political figure and not someone who's defending apolitical intelligence.
And what about Mike Hayden tweeting a picture of Birkenau in response to the family separation policy? Again, nowhere near a line of ethical propriety with respect to, you know, his former role, any of his former roles. On the other hand, you know, it's quite a statement, and it upset a lot of people. I take it that's similarly within your area of concern about prudence.
So I don't know that example. I can't really comment on it, but I would just say that, yes, when, again, just to repeat it, and I don't know the Hayden example, but it confirms for many people an inference that this is not about defending apolitical intelligence, but it's about political disagreements with the president. And to the extent that these folks represent the intelligence community, it confirms the narrative of the president. I don't see, and I'll just say one more thing and then let David respond. And I do this myself, and I try not to, and that is respond to the president's kind of in the gutter way of proceeding and attacking people. And people sometimes, and I'm not saying any of those statements quite fall to this level, but people don't behave the way towards him that they would normally behave towards the president. And that may well be justified, but it hurts the people who descend to that level of discourse. And again, I've done it myself, and I try not to.
All right. So what do you think, David? So this is a set of criticisms that now goes beyond the kind of trading on prior access to information and intelligence authority to make the claims that, at least in my case, I really, really suspect to be true and suspect the ultimate investigation is going to bear out, but that we don't know yet and may never know, and goes to just a style of conversation and political rhetoric and substantive political statement by these officials toward the president. Should they be doing that stuff?
Well, a couple of sort of thoughts up front. First of all, some of that stronger language, I have to say, is not my personal style. It is, as I said, all I can do just to even use the Twitter at all, as opposed to submitting another indecipherable law review length article to you, Ben. And so some of this is a question of just personal style. I am most comfortable when I write something that I absolutely know that no one will read. The effectiveness-based critique of that sort of use of colorful language, I also think is a legitimate one. Reasonable minds can disagree about what's effective. As to whether it's norm-based, you know, the president is an extremist, and qualitatively as well as quantitatively extreme, as we've talked about earlier. And so I think he provokes, you know, strong responses. But I actually think this is not a bad segue into my broader potential disagreement with Jack. And here I'm simultaneously less certain that I am reading Jack correctly, or I should say that I think my critique is more subjective, and also at the same time a little bit think it's more likely that Jack will take a stronger disagreement with me here than we did on the first, a narrower one. But let me just say it with all of those grains of salt and see if it helps illuminate this question you're raising about people using strong language. My broader concern is that Jack's presentation, which is focused on the convergence of Trump and anti-Trump excesses, has a tendency to obscure, I think, rather than illuminate what I think of as the real problem here. And so it makes me uncomfortable. This is a subjective critique, and it may very well, you know, be one that Jack just utterly rejects. I don't say, Jack, that you equate the Trump and anti-Trump excessive behaviors by any means, but I do think that the sort of fundamental structural outlook that you're bringing to this is one of comparing and comparison between the two in a meaningful way, in your view. And to me, and again, I hope this will help shed some light on the specific questions Ben asked. To me, that's a little bit like saying that, you know, the patient is very ill due to the unfortunate convergence of cancer and chemotherapy. That is, the cancer, which in this analogy would be the president, and forgive me if that's too strong, you know, a language here, but is sort of unequivocally bad for the body politic. It is a sickness and it represents harm to the patient. The chemotherapy can, which is done in response to and as an effort to address and potentially get rid of the cancer and cure it, as it were, or to at least counter it and hold it at bay, can have its own excesses. It's very difficult to calibrate the right dose of chemotherapy for especially aggressive kinds of cancer that you haven't encountered before, or at least not recently. And it can do some short-term collateral damage to your hair or your bone marrow or whatever, or other bodily systems, because it is sort of a poison. And it can do some long-term damage too. But I really think it's quite a different thing from an ethical standpoint, from a norm-based perspective anyway. And I worry that describing our current predicament as lying at the convergence of these two things, even if they're not equated, it brings them too closely together. We can certainly talk about whether, you know, the dosage of response needs to be toned down, or perhaps in some cases it needs to be toned up a little bit, and you have to calibrate that carefully, and we are all, you know, the doctors make mistakes. But I just worry that putting them side by side in that way, even though I know you're very careful not to equate them, and I don't want to over-rotate on this, and as I said, I think it's a subjective thing, that it's my perception, they're just really different in my view. And so it's totally legitimate to say there's too much chemotherapy and, you know, whatever, it's this, that, we got to tone it down a little bit, change the dosage. But I just don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think there are some really, really deep differences here. And I'm worried about losing sight of what's the primary concern as opposed to sort of a secondary or tertiary concern.
Okay. So this is a huge issue. And Jack, let's kick it to you just to talk about symmetry and asymmetry here.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised this, David. So first of all, I actually used a very similar metaphor when I first talked about this in a piece I wrote in The Atlantic about a year ago. And I called what the intelligence community's, what I took as its norm violations. I was thinking of the FISA stuff then. I actually described it as an immune response to attacks from the president. So that's not unlike the metaphor you use.
That's similar.
And I do think that that's a good way to describe it. So that's the first point. Second point is, and I tried to make this clear in that piece. And if you looked at the percentage of times that I have blamed the president for our troubles versus criticizing intelligence officials who attack the president, it's probably 1,000 or 2,000 to 1. So I mean, I'm not trying to say at all, and I try to make that clear in the piece, that Trump's bad behavior is like the behavior I'm criticizing. My main concern, and this is the concern that I expressed in The Atlantic, and it's the concern I have here, is whether two concerns. One is the effectiveness point, whether this is more helpful than hurtful. And I think that's the way most of these things, I try to think of these things in instrumental terms and cost-benefit terms. And on that question, it's easier for me to tell in some contexts than others, and I acknowledge that sometimes it's hard to tell. The other fundamental point, and again, this is something I made in the Atlantic piece, and this is a bigger worry, and I don't know what to do about this. I think there's no comparison to what Trump's done versus what the people who've responded to what Trump's done. There's just no comparison. It's impossible that anything would be nearly as bad as what the president has done and been doing. And obviously, I've made that clear 100 times in 100 writings since he was elected. But here's what I worried about in The Atlantic, and it's what I still worry about now. All the norms the president is violating, or many of them, I'm pretty confident, we'll see if I'm right or wrong, or that they will snap back, and that we won't see the next president attacking the intelligence community. We won't see the next president, with the exception of the media. That may well continue because it preceded the president. I actually think a lot of the norm violations of the presidency will end up strengthening. Those norms won't be destroyed. They'll be strengthened as a result of Trump along many dimensions in a way that's similar to what happened in Watergate. On the other hand, the norm violations by the intelligence community and former intelligence community officials, by the media, as I said in the Atlantic piece, I worry that those won't snap back. You know, once you've leaked a bunch of FISA warrants and seen that they were very effective in achieving a political end, you know, the taboo was off of that. And even the judgment that, well, this president is acting in bad faith, therefore we can attack him, a lot of people thought that George W. Bush and Barack Obama acted in bad faith. And once it becomes acceptable to conclude someone is acting in bad faith, therefore we can act in this unusual way, I really worry about that norm breaking down. So those are my concerns.
Yeah. We share certain views. I mean, I think the FISA norm violation is actually a more specific to FISA, and I attribute most of it to Devin Nunes and what he's done in concert with the president or the White House or on his own. I can't.
Yeah, totally I agree with that too.
I think that, you know, I do think that it's helpful to have this conversation. As I sort of said at the outset, it could be that my subjective take on your framing is a misunderstanding, and I think we actually are coming closer together on things. I guess you said something like your ratio of critique of Trump to the others is 2,000 to 1, and so maybe I need it to be 3,000 to 1 or something. You know, I do not think you are equating them, but I know that when I read your stuff, which I do a lot, and I love reading it, I often, when you're talking about these issues, just come away with a sort of an intuitive feeling that it's out of balance in the sense that you're trying to be balanced about it. And again, I'm not saying you're equating. So maybe it's just a question of degree there. And finally, I guess it's interesting. I don't know whether all of these norm violations that we're seeing on the Trump side and the other side will recede. And you and I and Bob Bauer have talked about this before. I am hopeful that the fabric will snap back into shape rather than tearing under the stress that it's currently experiencing. But I guess I believe, and here's where that chemo analogy comes back in, or the immune response. I guess I think if the cancer or the virus leaves the system, the immune response will also likely recede. It's possible that it won't, that only the anti-Trump norm violations would sustain and the Trump violations will all recede. But I sort of think it's likely they will go hand in hand. And if they don't, then people like you and me and others of good conscience will have to, you know, hammer pretty hard on that. Because I think the basis of critique of this president is not, at least by intelligence community and military folks, you know, is just not that he's calling for a tax cut or something. You know, it's this more qualitative stuff. But I do think, just sort of to give you one measure of it, of how really extreme it is, and I don't think you have any quarrel with this, even the active duty service chiefs felt an obligation to say something after Charlottesville and after the president's comments on Charlottesville. And I cannot imagine what that must have cost them to do that, because it, you know, that is probably the place where the norms against criticizing a sitting president are the absolute strongest, in the current active duty service chiefs. But, you know, that to me is a hallmark of how really extreme things are here. And so it informs the way I view the whole thing. And again, that's why I maybe want a 3,000 to 1 rather than a 2,000 to 1 ratio.
Yeah, on the last point, I don't want to understate how awful. I mean, I agree that, you know, the fact that the service chief spoke out there was extraordinary. There's so many things that have happened in response to the president that are extraordinary and justified in context. And as I tried to say in this last piece, there's just no good option either for the current official. You know, Ben and I have written a lot about whether Ray and Rosenstein and Sessions have stood up to the president enough or not enough. It's just an incredibly difficult, sensitive set of trade-offs. And for the service chiefs, the same thing. And frankly, as I said in that piece, for the former officials, you know, some of them have been on television speaking out, and a lot of them have remained silent. And I think that is you know, it's contextual, it's personal, and I think it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult because there's so many competing considerations and so many costs and benefits.
Yeah.
So I don't want to understate how extraordinary any of these, you know, the situation is. And how
Can I just say, before you get to your second, I just riffing off of that, I mean, I don't think I don't want to be understood as saying there is actually an obligation to speak out. I do think that's a personal question. I just think I have felt one. And I think that's the relevant norm-based question here is there an obligation or merely a permission to speak out harshly, when the normal question is there an obligation to remain more silent? So I just sort of think the norm has turned on its head in an interesting way because of the massively changed topography on which it's being overlaid. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I'm fine. It's good. The second point is, picking up on what you said about if the norms don't recover after Trump leaves on the intelligence community side or on the media side, then you said something to the effect that we should and will criticize them then. So that's where we may disagree. One of the things that motivates me now in making some of these criticisms, and to be very clear, I know a lot of these people. Some of them are my good friends, and I admire the intelligence community, and I've made that clear for a long time. So I don't enjoy – it's not fun for me to criticize Brennan. I like him, and I admire him, and I've worked with him before. But I actually think it's important to flag these norm violations now, not later, because I think it may help invite a return to those norms. And so I think it's important to point out now how extraordinary these things are, how much of a departure they are, to question what the limits are, to try to keep it within bounds. So anyway, that's I won't say that's my main motivation, but it's part of it.
No, and I actually phrase that way, I have no disagreement at all. And in fact, I think I agree. We have to flag and police our activity and calibrate the dosage of the response. I just, and again, this is really just a question of emphasis now and perception, but I don't want, as we pay attention to the chemo dose, and that is important, I just don't want to lose sight. And sometimes I feel like that could happen, that we don't lose sight of the primary concern here that is threatening the patient's life in a fundamental way, as opposed to good faith, I believe, good faith efforts to counter that toxicity. But a lot of what you've said, Jack, has sort of helped clarify that you're not trying to obscure or equate or, you know, lose sight of the horrific nature of the primary concern here. But that's what motivates my perspective on this at some fundamental level.
So I actually want to, if I can, make a stronger case for loud public, sometimes inappropriate statements on the part of the former intelligence community leadership. And I want to be clear that I'm doing it not because I necessarily believe what I'm about to say, but because I think it would be useful to inject this sensibility into the conversation. But so I'll, reserving the question of whether I actually believe it, here's the argument. There is, in this truly extraordinary moment, the norm rules don't actually apply because the norms are predicated on this idea, not merely that the president is acting in good faith, but that the questions that we're discussing are factually and from a policy point of view, reasonably debatable. And, you know, John Brennan and Mike Hayden, they made some kind of commitment to be politically neutral. They never made a commitment to be neutral between truth and falsehood. They never made a commitment to be not outraged by, you know, abuses of their community and serial lying. And so I have this part of me reacts to this and says, if that brings out a kind of pugilistic instinct in some of them where they are, as Bill Buckley would say, standing athwart the tide of history and shouting no, I'm not sure why I should be offended by that. And the fact that it is done in this relentlessly nonpartisan fashion, that is, you know, it's sometimes it's John McLaughlin, and sometimes it's Mike Hayden, and sometimes it's Brennan, and sometimes it's Mike Morrell. And they all sound, I mean, they're tonally different because they're different people, but you can't really tell from the substance of what they're saying which are Democrats and which are Republicans. It really is, you know, if you're the president, the deep state raising its voice, or if you're the rest of us, it's, you know, the professional intelligence apparatus speaking with, you know, different inflections of a single voice. And that actually makes it powerful. And it has the effect of isolating the Devin Nunes's to some degree and identifying who is and who isn't, you know, plausibly speaking within the sort of bipartisan, nonpartisan traditions that these norms actually represent. So my, you know, I don't know whether that's the view that I actually take, but what's wrong with it? What's wrong with the idea that in a moment where, you know, all the rules are off on one side, that a group of people decide that at least some of the rules don't bind them in response?
I wouldn't frame it as right and wrong, Ben. It's certainly their prerogative to do that. And if they want to do that, they can. And I wouldn't say that it's wrong for them to do it. The question is, what for me is, first of all, I would say, especially if you're limiting it to calling the president on his lies about the intelligence community, calling out the president and Nunes on their attacks on the institutions, calling them out on their attempts to destroy the credibility of the institutions, certainly not wrong to do that. The question again, and I'm sorry to bring it back to the earlier conversation, is to what end? Is it effective? I have no doubt that it's hugely important for the morale of the people in the intelligence community for them to be doing it. And I expect that that's one of their main audiences and one of their main aims. And I expect that it's helpful in that regard. And the people certainly that I talk to who are in the intelligence community who've been there a long time are hugely demoralized by Trump. And I'm sure that they're helped for morale and other reasons when these officials do that. So before that audience, no problem. But in a way, you talked about it doing it in a bipartisan and apolitical way. But for another audience, and this is just another possibility, I think it's certainly true to some degree, what you describe as extreme attacks in the face of the president confirm the president's message. I mean, as Eli Lake wrote, he went after Brennan not because he was trying to silence Brennan. He pulled that security clearance not because he was trying to silence Brennan. Lake speculated he was trying to call him out. He wanted to make, you know, to draw out the hot-headedness and make him kind of confirm to his base that Brennan represents a certain viewpoint that the president finds illegitimate. So for me, this is almost entirely a question of is it effective or not? Except for crossing certain lines, which, you know, going off into political issues that aren't related to intelligence, in my judgment, going off and not being clear about relying on information concerning the Russia investigation, to the extent that they're standing up to his attacks on the intelligence community, you know, all power to them in terms of their right to do so. The question is whether it's a good idea and whether it's effective. And different people have made different judgments about that.
Right. So, and I agree, just like administering medicine can be very difficult and different doctors can differ. But I mean, Ben, your statement brings out two reactions for me. The first is, I think I agree with at least one part of the premise of it, which is we all favor an apolitical intelligence community, and we all see the importance of that to American democracy and to the paradigm of intelligence under law. And we all therefore think that even former senior intelligence officials are in some way regulated prudentially or otherwise by a norm. I just think my take on it is that in the current environment, it is more apolitical to criticize some of these truly outrageous and extreme actions by the president than it is to let them pass uncriticized. And so, again, that's more of a framing and perspective orientation on the issue than it is a way of answering whether any particular critique is valid or not. But I thought that you were saying something similar to that, and I agree with that way of thinking about it, even, you know, if the results that follow are not yet fixed. And I also think it's a way of restating or refining sort of my difference on Jack with Jack on the presentation. It just seems like, relatively speaking, the degree of norm deviation on the two sides here, if it exists, is just very, very different. And in a way, the scale on the two graphs, if you want, when placed side by side, is just at a totally different order of magnitude. That is to say, if there are some excesses, and I think that there may be in the responses that Trump has provoked, they are relatively, to my perspective at least, relatively fine-grained, relatively modest as against the norms by which you judge them, as compared to the president himself, who is just so far out of the norm, so far removed from what is foundational to our democracy. And I mean, you know, to give you an example, what I think Trump was doing fundamentally in revoking John Brennan's security clearance, I agree it had in a way a little bit to do with John. It was, I think, a very clear message to the millions of others, current and former, who may need their security clearance to do the jobs that they're doing. And it was a message that was, if you criticize this president on any basis, you stand to lose your clearance. And that is just so radically un-American that to say that they were too strong in criticizing him, I guess, just again, I have concerns about laying those two things side by side. Even if I might agree that there are some excesses on the anti-Trump side, they just seem to me to be dwarfed by the magnitude of the deviations and violations on Trump's own side.
Jack, final thoughts.
Can I try to sharpen this issue? Because yep. I think we're avoiding the issue a little bit. Again, I don't equate Trump's norm violations with these other norm violations. It's not comparable. There's nothing that's comparable to his norm violations. But we keep switching back between right and wrong and effective versus ineffective. So, Ben, let me ask you, would you hold that position? Maybe it's right to do so, but it's counterproductive in terms of affirming the president's agenda to undermine the intelligence community. And so I think we need to separate the question of, do they have a right to do this? Is it appropriate in the sense that certain actions require a response despite what the consequences are? So that's the ground on which I think you folks are, that David and you are arguing on. And I want to say the question for me is, and I think it's a tough question, and I said that in the piece, whether this is a good or bad idea from the perspective of protecting and preserving the intelligence community. And I think so I'm thinking about it purely instrumentally. So my question for you is, if it turned out that in some circumstances we could measure and it was the right thing to do, but it actually ended up hurting the intelligence community, which way would you choose? Because it might be, we've all said that costs and benefits are hard to calculate here, and the effectiveness is hard to calculate, but you seem to be suggesting it's a good idea anyway. And I want to suggest, let's not talk about whether it's in a non-instrumental way, right or wrong. Let's focus on whether it's a good or bad idea. What I tried to do in my piece was to outline, you know, there's a gray area, but outline some things that I didn't see how they could be effective in protecting the intelligence community. And I gave couple of examples of that. So if we can separate right from wrong in a non-instrumental sense from effective versus ineffective, and if it turned out to be right but counterproductive, how would you choose as to whether they should be doing this?
Well, so that's a really tough question, and it's a tough question for me, honestly, because I've been, you know, to some degree dealing with that in some of how I think about, for example, what to say about what's going on at the FBI or the Justice Department, right? Where I do think there is, as have you, right? You know, I do think as a normative matter, it is wrong for Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions not to be speaking out publicly more than they are, and Chris Wray as well. And as a prudential and effectiveness matter, I can't make an argument for that, because if they speak loudly, they'll get their heads chopped off, and that's not really useful for anybody. And so I do think that there's something of a similar dynamic here, although the stakes are lower because we're dealing with former officials, not current officials. And so I do work on the assumption that the costs are lower and the pros are higher when you're dealing with former officials, and therefore that there's higher positive value on truth-telling speech. That said, look, I know the answer to your question because I've faced it in thinking about how to think about Rod Rosenstein. And if I thought that telling the truth in a sustained and aggressive way were going to be counterproductive in this area, I would react to it exactly the way I do with respect to Rod Rosenstein, which is, it's a shame he can't, but, you know, I'm not going to criticize him for not speaking out more because there's a higher value right now, which is effectiveness. And so I actually know the answer to the question that you're asking, and I think it's exactly the one your question suggests. I just don't know that I don't know that I think it's likely that in the particular case that we're thinking about, there actually is a particularly high negative consequence to the behavior right. that I'd like to see.
I think this helps me to frame exactly what I was trying to do in that piece, which is not always obvious when you're writing the piece. What I tried to do there at the end, thanks to some suggestions from you, Ben, was to outline what I thought was the prudential way to proceed in the face of this instrumental uncertainty about whether it's effective or not. And I acknowledge that there's a gray area and it's not clear whether this is helpful or hurtful or has any impact at all in terms of intelligence community credibility and reputation and institutional viability or the president's success. But I think with some of the more extreme statements, when it gets more political and more strident and gets away from the intelligence community, I think there the cost-benefit analysis, you know, it becomes clearer. And I think that the kind of non-instrumental justification for doing that becomes clearer. And so that's what I'm trying to call attention to. And we don't really know what the consequences are here, but it might be that in some context, these officials are acting in a self-defeating way.
So, David, wrap us up. Give us some final thoughts.
Well, first of all, I always love talking to you guys, and I hope that people listening to this find it as helpful, informative, and thought-provoking as I have found it. I think, Jack, I would not have had the reaction to your piece that I did, either in its draft form or in its final form, if I thought that it was mainly instrumental in its outlook rather than normative. I myself am inclined to look at this through an instrumental lens as well. I want to preserve not just the intelligence community, but sort of fundamental elements of U.S. democracy, which I think are in jeopardy and under stress right now. I agree also that it's very hard to know whether and to what extent any course of reactive behavior will or will not work well or badly in the short run, in the long run, with this potential audience and with that one. But I guess, again, and I think this reflects just a different angle of attack on the question that I think we keep coming back to, is I just am overwhelmed by the dangers in excessive restraint or in remaining silent. And I know you don't suggest silence, and I know you leave a lot of room for, you know, critiques, but I just worry about too fine-grained a judgment on those at a time where you're facing a very dynamic and unpredictable and almost unprecedented set of problems. And I think, you know, as I weigh and balance the risks of excess in response as against the risks of too much restraint in response, I think I am inclined to allow for people to really let it hang out and call a spade a shovel, up to some point, of course. I don't mean to say there are no limits, but I see the danger more on the side of passivity than too much active response.
Jack, final thoughts.
Yeah, final thoughts. I just want to, so these are all very helpful exchanges. I've learned a lot from this. I just want to close by saying that it's really one of the most extraordinary things about this presidency that he so discombobulates the usual way of doing business. He so discombobulates the norms of normal behavior in Washington. He so discombobulates truth and falsity. It's one of the really extraordinary things that it's not obvious how to respond to it. Ben, you and I have had this discussion from the day he was elected.
Yep.
About whether the right response was to be really aggressive in response or to be as detached as possible, and whether being detached was in a way affirming and normalizing what he's doing, and whether therefore you need to be very forward-leaning in attacking him, or whether that in turn, the forward-leaningness helped him because of the strange things he does in politics. This whole discussion, I think, and this whole issue highlights that point yet again. Yep. And it's one of the most extraordinary things about his presidency.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you, David Chris and Jack Goldsmith. This is the first time we have ever had a Lawfare podcast that literally emerges out of comments sent to a Lawfare writer on a draft post. And I think it's a remarkable discussion, and I thank you both for having it, both in email and orally.
I also want to thank David, because the piece that he originally read and the piece that was published, they were different, and it was much better because of his comments.
Well, thank you. And I've enjoyed both the email and the oral conversation very much. It's extremely, extremely helpful and thought-provoking. Thank you, guys.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced this week, as every week, in conjunction with the Brookings Institution. We are building up a reservoir of reviews and ratings on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast distribution services, but we are not satisfied. We want you guys to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, rate the Lawfare Podcast, review the Lawfare Podcast, and share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook. We also want you to donate to Lawfare and get one of our awesome new challenge coins. And yes, you can do that through our post on the site. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as ever, thanks for listening.